Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of All Things Policy. My name is Kripa Koshi, and I'm a program manager at the Takshashila Institution. And today I have the pleasure of being joined by my colleague, Saurabh Todi, who is a research analyst working with the high-tech geopolitics program. But I have to admit that I've roped Saurabh in here today not to talk about anything related to HTG, but about another controversy, actually, that's been playing out on headlines across the country. But before I jump into that today, I just want to welcome Saurabh. Welcome, Saurabh.
Thank you, Kripa. Always a pleasure to be here and looking forward to discussing a non-HTG topic, but something that's very, very, very important. And I think it needs a larger debate and discussion for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to leave our listeners in suspense, but today's topic of discussion is going to be the Nestle sugar controversy. So as many of you have been following the news probably very closely, you've been seeing how some of the actions really taken by Nestle's baby food products segment in particular have been cause for a lot of speculation and debate, not just in India, but really internationally, because of a particular report that has been released that addresses the sugar content in a lot of the baby food products that are being sold by Nestle. So many of you already know probably what the debate really is about, what the controversy is. But for the benefit of those who might not have had a chance to go through some of the detail of this, I'll cover a little bit of context. And then I'll invite Saurabh also to join me and sort of debate and discuss some of our thoughts around India's response, regulations, other controversies maybe that have played out similarly in the past. So just to catch you up, so a report that was recently released by a Swiss NGO called the Public Eye and International Baby Food Action Network, or IBFAN, I'm going to choose that as the acronym, has released this report that actually says that with Nestle baby food products sold in India, as well as in African and Latin American countries, test has shown that they actually have a higher sugar content in comparison to the exact same products that are being sold actually in European markets. So for this analysis, about 150 baby products that were manufactured by Nestle were tested in a Belgian lab. But the chief concern really was Cerelac products. And they actually found that 15 Cerelac products for directed usually towards six-month-old babies, which are typically sold without any added sugar in the UK and Germany and such, actually contain 2.7 grams of added sugar per serving in India. Maybe even slightly more alarming might be that the products that were sold in Ethiopia and Thailand actually contained 6 grams, according to this report. So why really this cause for concern? I think, of course, instinctively, we can see the disparity across how these products are produced and really distributed in different markets. But there actually are certain guidelines that have been set out by the WHO that provide recommendations around sugar additions for children, right? So they've particularly highlighted that, you know, children at the age of 3 years should probably not be consuming sugar. However, we do see that Indian regulators do allow for a limited amount of sucrose and fructose to be included in baby foods. As well, there are regulations around labeling. So, you know, Nestle's baby products that are sold in the Indian market do have to clearly state that the products that they're selling contain added sugar, apart from other, you know, disclosures. So Indian regulation actually goes further to say that they have requirements for macronutrients that should be added in certain products. So proteins, fats, carbs, essential micronutrients like certain vitamins, you know, iron and zinc. But actually, Indian regulation doesn't state when it comes to infant nutrition, there isn't really an upper limit for added sugars. It's been explicitly stated. And I think the last thing really of note is trying to understand the market as well that we're speaking of. So Nestle actually sold over 20,000 crore worth of products, specifically Cerelac products actually, in India in 2022 alone. So just to give you a sense of like how widespread, really how active sort of the organization is in India, but also to sort of outline some of the regulation standards. One last point I'll just sort of mention is how this report was received, right? So a lot of countries, I imagine, woke up, you know, last week and suddenly there's this report saying that, you know, Nestle has been distributing these products which have sugar content that consumers might not be happy with. But look, what does the Indian response really look like? So April 18th, as some of you may know, the FSSAI, so the Food Safety and Standards Authority of India, noted that it's going to look into this report. As you know, the FSSAI actually regulates manufacture, storage, distribution, sale, import of food articles, and they also establish standards actually to ensure food safety. On the 19th, we see that the Union Consumer Affairs Ministry asked for the FSSAI to actually initiate, in quotation, appropriate action against the Nestle Group. So there's been a lot of back and forth conversation on how to respond to the controversy. And then lastly, I'll just sort of close things off with what Nestle's response has been. You know, we have on record now a Nestle India spokesperson who said that, you know, reducing added sugar actually is something that the company is aware of and has tried to prioritize. They put out a statistic saying that, you know, over the last 5 years, added sugars have been reduced by up to 30% in their infant cereal products. And a key, you know, word that really we're pulling out here in their statement is the word compliance. So they say compliance is an essential characteristic of Nestle India, and we will never compromise on that. They also claim to have been in compliance with Codex standards, which is this commission actually that's established by the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization. And they also make it a point to specify that local specifications related to the requirements of all nutrients, including added sugars, have been something that we've paid close attention to. So I'm going to maybe at this moment, now that I've sort of laid a little bit of a groundwork of what we're going to be discussing, maybe invite Saurabh to sort of share some of his thoughts. This idea of, you know, compliance to local regulations seems to be something that they are really stressing here. You know, they're not saying that they have an adherence to WHO standards. Was not the first thing they wanted to say. They said, you know, we are really compliant with what local standards are on these issues. So I guess my question to you, Saurabh, would be, you know, how much should WHO standards factor into how a company might be producing and manufacturing certain products, as well, how much should WHO standards be something of concern even to states as they are trying to regulate according to, you know, what they find is best for their citizens?
Yeah, thank you, Kripa. I think in this case, if you see, I think one thing we need to understand is that obviously a lot of thinking and research goes into developing these regulations by the WHO. So those are like released after a lot of discussion and understanding of the problem. So the idea is that countries will be able to find this resource where, okay, they're like, okay, this is the standard to follow. So they don't have to invest that much into, you know, trying to develop their own standards. But this is not something that is a requirement. Each country can decide to, you know, adopt standards as told by WHO. Some countries would have a standard which go a notch above. Some countries may go a bit lower as well. So it really depends. So I think that first part is about regulation, where how much, like what kind of regulation do you have? And then the second important aspect is, do you have the capacity to actually even understand what the regulation is? So for example, let's not, you know, be under this illusion that, you know, Nestle thought that it would be like they were being nice by not adding sugars in the baby formulas in UK and Germany. It is perhaps because the regulations there prohibit any addition or something like that. And that is because they had the capacity and understanding, and they invested in research to, you know, figure out what suits for them and, you know, how far and beyond from current regulations, both global and domestic, they have to go to adopt something like that. Now, is that the case in India? I'm not very sure, right? Because it's very interesting that they focused on compliance in the statement, like the company, because seemingly they are in compliance with the Indian regulations. So if Indian regulations, as you stated, they allow addition of a small amount of fructose and glucose, and I mean sugars, that the fact that they have it is not illegal. It is not a violation of any law or any regulation. So legally, they are not under any obligation to not add sugars. Now, would it be helpful if India had, you know, regulation that, okay, you should not do that? Perhaps. But why did we not do that? Is it because perhaps we don't have that foresight or understanding or capacity to want to say that, okay, you know, maybe these are the rules, but for in the Indian context or for us, you know, we don't want our baby formulas to have sugar. Or there may be a reason that we allowed for it. But the point I'm trying to make is that there has to be enough capacity in regulations to kind of, you know, make sure that the regulations enable best practices. And much more important also is the fact that you have the capacity to enforce those regulations. That is a very, very big issue. You can have the best regulations, but if you can't enforce them, then there's not much that you can do about it.
No, I think those are, you know, incredibly valuable points that you're raising, Saurabh. Like, we do need to add a little bit of nuance then to that conversation around, you know, it's not as simple as saying, yes, let's regulate more, but actually let's, you know, follow that those actions down the continuum of then what the enforcement of some of those regulations would even look like and if we have the bandwidth to do something like this. I think something that I wanted to get your thoughts on was, you know, an earlier component of that question of, you know, should corporates actually be looking to the WHO themselves to establish guidelines for their own practices, and really, and to continue on that conversation, you know, should enforcement of these food safety standards be left entirely to the state? Like, could there be a greater role for markets or in this instance, like an MNC to play? And I'm thinking of, you know, one particular example that came up in my research was, you know, that there are instances where companies are strongly motivated by sometimes ethical considerations. So, you know, in the early 90s, Unilever actually decided to conduct research on trans fats, despite the fact that really at the time, trans fats were considered to be safe, were used in production of several food products. But when they did that research and found that trans fats did have a more negative impact on heart health, for example, and it was reported eventually in the media, they decided in 94 to remove trans fats from all of their margarines and spreads, you know. And at the time, it was seen as not an action that was motivated purely by, you know, a market share that they were trying to tap into and have access to, but that they truly felt like this was an area of concern for them and that they wanted to explore. Now, I don't think we can divorce, you know, a profit motivation from that research entirely, but it's interesting to see that there was initiative that was taken nonetheless that actually shaped, you know, potentially consumer habits, that shaped actually even, you know, regulations that may have come around some of these practices. So what are some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I mean, those are interesting points. First of all, I think the regulations that WHO has or these, you know, guidelines are there to actually kind of help many, many countries, because not every country has the capacity or expertise or resources to do these research, you know, for their own country. So these guidelines are essentially there to help countries to, okay, you have this ready-made kind of a guideline, you can just adopt this, and I think this would be enough. Now, there is also the issue of state sovereignty. I think WHO can't say that, okay, you have to have these guidelines. I mean, you can have certain guidelines, you know, for procurement and all, because then the WHO may want to procure something. So, for example, let's say WHO for their relief kind of work, or the UN, let's say, for their relief work procures like hundreds or thousands of tons of, let's say, baby formula, right? For that, they may say that, okay, we will only procure baby formula that doesn't have sugar or something like that. But they can't, you know, force countries to adopt a specific regulation. So I think at the end, it is the country who decides, you know, what kind of, to what extent a certain regulation has to be adopted. Now, we also can't really depend on, you know, the ethical largesse of a company. Be like, okay, they are nice. I think when we are doing regulation, we have to take into account everybody. So if the regulation is as such that, you know, keeps itself concurrent with the latest research, and that those guidelines are regularly updated, there is enough enforcement, I think it would help be a, you know, self-regulating mechanism, where there is not much of, you know, like external prodding needed, because the regulatory environment is strong and resilient enough that you don't need any other interventions. Now, a company may decide to go above and beyond those regulations and make it more safer. That is a choice that a company can make, and it would reap both ethical and financial dividends. But I am not sure if we can rely on companies to self-regulate to a point where you are, in a way, replacing, or at least, you know, like running in parallel to the state level agencies.
Yeah, I think those are definitely valuable points to incorporate. And of course, I don't think there would be, you know, in this instance, a substitutable effect necessarily that we're looking at. But insofar as where can, you know, MNCs such as these sort of step up, or can we hold them accountable to step up themselves rather than expecting for the state exclusively to wield the weapon of regulation almost, you know, first and foremost to guide some of the production activity of these MNCs. I'm curious, Sarah, because I think there was, you know, there's people who've maybe been following Nestlé's activity over the past little while will know that this is not the first time that Nestlé has been in the news when it comes to concerns around a lot of their, you know, food production practices. Or really, there have been so many different facets of their activity that have been scrutinized beyond just, you know, production of food, you know, it's marketing, many different things. But would you maybe like to comment a little bit on, I think there was the Maggi noodles controversy in 2015 that Nestlé got a lot of flack for. So is there something that you think there's a valuable lesson there for us to reflect on?
Yeah. So, I mean, if our listeners would remember, like in 2015, there was this huge controversy that, you know, the random samples of Maggi were tested and they were reported to have a significantly higher amount of lead and MSG than were prescribed. And they were also, you know, in contrast to what was like mentioned in the marketing materials, like no added MSG, but there was MSG, right? So it led to a huge, huge controversy. About 30,000 metric tons of Maggi were recalled. It cost about 450 crore rupee loss to Nestlé. So, okay, this was, you know, like a big deal. It came in the news and everything. But it is also important to see what happened after that. So within a few months, you know, the company was back. We don't know much, you know, like what happened. I mean, and to what intense. And then there were some reports that, okay, the testing did not show those enhanced amounts of lead or MSG, but it was tested in some other labs. So there's again, so this is the issue that I'm talking about regarding capacity, right? Do you have equal standards? Are you able to do the testing in a manner which, you know, will lead to more consistent results? Also, only earlier this month, I mean, after, you know, 9 years of litigation, the government actually complained about Nestlé to the Consumer Redressal Forum that they engaged in unfair trade practices, you know, by promoting their product as having no lead or MSG, but they did. But the consumer code actually ruled in favor of Nestlé. So what does it say? Like, I am not saying that, you know, companies are all innocent. I mean, obviously there is a significant profit motive. There is a significant element to, you know, try to reduce the liability and everything. But what this kind of experience shows us is that any ad hoc response will not work. Or at least it will only work in satiating our desire to see like some action being taken so that we forget about it like after 2 weeks. But the situation doesn't change. Even now, you know, like the, as you said, that the government and FSSAI has issued notices to Nestlé on their baby formula. Yeah, that's fine. But like, as you have said, that if there was no kind of compliance problem, then we're not doing much. You can issue notices, you can file cases, you can find it out in the court to just show that you are doing something. But are regulations keeping current? And then more is that you also want a certain level of policy certainty. You don't want to be seen as somebody, you know, who just will go after companies because, you know, some big reports came. So I'm saying that what we need is proper regulation, methodology, like a structured way of, you know, enforcing those regulations and making sure that the, like, we are not reactive in our approach to these, but proactive and also like reflective, and so many like IVE words here. But again, don't be reactive, be proactive and also reflective based on, you know, what your prior experience is, because just, you know, following the news of the day will not help. But I'll also say something, I think, and also very interesting example of only like last year is that this one YouTuber actually highlighted that the excessive amount of sugar that was there in Cadbury's Bournvita. It is like a extra chocolate flavor nutrition powder that you add to milk. I mean, we all grew up drinking some form of, you know, Horlicks, Milo, Complan, Bournvita, like all of that kind of the whole shelf of those. But yeah, so because of that, I mean, this was again awesome, like a YouTuber who highlighted that this was a significantly higher level of sugar, which is not good for health, which also, you know, there's also some issues with labeling. And this led to actually Cadbury. And I mean, first they filed a case to obviously shut that YouTuber, and then he did delete the video. But then by that time, I think there was enough controversy, there was enough awareness, there was enough outrage that the company actually did finally reduce the amount of sugar by 17%. I mean, 40 or 70. So that is a substantial amount of difference. So in this case, nobody had to, you know, scream, shout, howl. I mean, that poor YouTuber had to for all our benefit. But this was a completely citizen-led kind of an action which led to improvement. So I think these are one of the few examples. And I think one example also internationally would be that in, I think, around 2008 is when there was this huge controversy that milk that was being sold in China had a lot of other synthetic additives, which actually were quite harmful to humans, especially to babies. And there were some babies who actually were killed as a result of consuming contaminated milk. A few thousands had to be hospitalized. And that has created like a significant outrage against the Chinese regulators and, you know, how it was possible and all of that. So, I mean, and this actually led to a significant awareness about these regulations, that the fact that this led to increase in consumer awareness, you know, what should be done, how should one take labeling. And also in that sense, I think it is important to make sure that we are aware of our rights as a consumer, and we also demand accountability.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you brought up those examples, Saurabh, because I think it really helps sort of contextualize a lot of this conversation to get a sense of how some of, you know, these similar, you know, scenarios have sort of played out in the Indian context and sort of play out even some of these regulatory issues that we're discussing, right? So, and, you know, I'll tag on maybe one last example as we, you know, near the end of our episode here. But, you know, so we've sort of chronologically been moving backward and pulling up examples in Nestle's storied history of how they've been interacting with their consumers. But, you know, really, I think maybe for listeners who may have been following the organization for a while, when they think of controversy in Nestle, I'm sure some listeners might think of, you know, the 1977 criticism that Nestle faced around their campaign where they were actually actively discouraging breastfeeding in an effort to promote their baby formula. And at the time, the response really was a boycott, really. And that's what a lot of, you know, consumers felt was an appropriate response when they felt like the marketing practices of the organization were not up to standard. There was a widespread boycott of Nestle products in the US and Europe, and this lasted actually until 1984. Where eventually Nestle chose to adhere to the international marketing code that the WHO had endorsed at the time. So this idea being that, you know, sure, we are speaking of how, you know, regulatory compliance is something that, you know, we want to be proactive about. Establishing our regulatory framework is something that we don't want to be so fickle in how we're approaching it that, you know, we're, you know, as the wind blows, we're sort of moving here and there. But if there is, you know, significant consumer concern around how certain products are being produced, and, you know, I don't need to outline maybe what some of those concerns would be for children under the age of 2 consuming sugar. You know, there's extensive WHO guidance actually around how that's problematic for children and how that actually promotes, you know, the likelihood of non-communicable diseases as well in young kids, you know, eventually for children to have those types of concerns. So there is that. But if there is a significantly concerned, you know, consumer base, that there is room for them to be reactive then in those instances and to speak up and to hold companies accountable to standards that they might feel are not reflected in a country's regulatory code sometimes, right? Just to add on that one example, is there something you wanted to add to that, Saurabh, before we...
Yeah, so I think those are quite valid and very important points. And I would also say that, you know, this is not in the... There are issues, you know, regarding regulatory capacity, enforcement capacity, state capacity to do all of these things. And these also spans across many other domains. So we are talking about today about food security. But only a few weeks ago, there was a report that the Central Drugs Standard Control Organization, or the CDS CO, which is the regulatory authority for drugs in India, it issued an alert, you know, after about 50% of the samples failed quality testing. So imagine 50% of the drugs that was, you know, randomly collected from the batches. And these included like around 50 of the most commonly used kind of drugs. And that is very, very concerning, right? Because the whole point of taking medicine is hoping that you will get better, and you will only get better if that medicine actually works. And it will not work if it is not of good quality, or if, you know, if it is not of adequate standard. So I think that is something that is extremely, extremely important. And my reason of highlighting this is the fact that as consumers, we have to be very careful. We have to demand that accountability. And this it spans across many other domains. And something as important and as crucial as our food, as our medicines, I think we have to have much higher standard of what we expect out of our regulators and what we expect out of our leaders. So I think, I hope this is something that actually gets a lot more attention. And also, just to say, the very last point is that we also need to make sure that, you know, we don't follow the mob rule. Like, the whole point of having consistent, informed, scientifically bad regulations is that if there's a media outrage on something, but there is a scientific backing towards that regulation, that also needs to be protected. Because again, kind of mob effect does not make for good policy, or at least a good resilient regulation. So balancing that, I think, is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, I mean, as our awareness grows, as Indians become more informed, they are more online, they see a lot more information, I think this information asymmetry, which is kind of one of the reasons why companies and regulators are able to kind of get away with having substandard products and regulations, I think that hopefully would impose a much higher cost in due course of time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Saurabh. And I think that might be a good point for us to conclude our conversation today with all those sort of key themes that you highlighted there around accountability, about having an informed sort of citizenry. And then lastly, as well, making sure that, you know, we are looking to evidence and rigorous research always to inform our policy actions. So yeah, I hope that we've left, you know, our listeners today with a lot of food for thought. And hopefully it is a useful sort of frames of that can be applied to other areas, as we know, you know, we'll be following along to see how this controversy evolves. But similarly, to apply some of the themes that we've and the questions that we have brought can be brought to so many other issues, I think, that are playing out in the current context. So thank you so much for your time, Saurabh. A pleasure, as always, to have this conversation with you. And yeah, to our listeners, thank you for joining us today. And I encourage you to click next and listen to our next episode. Thanks and goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at takshashilainst or our website takshashila.org.in.